Hello and welcome back to the second part of OneFlip's podcast on Facebook's Libra, where we will focus on the technology practicalities of Libra and the Libra blockchain. We resume the conversation with Christian Catalini, head economist and co-creator of Libra, and Tionis Brussens, lead economist of digital finance at ING Group.
Okay, so we understand the objectives of Libra, but practically, can the existing technologies meet some of these objectives? Is it scalable enough? Is it secure? Is it resilient to the current standards for payment systems? Christian, do you think that this is all doable?
So yesterday, I was just talking with one of our leading researchers on the engineering side about this. And what's fascinating is that when you think about the protocol, Libra is built on technology that has been around the intellectual space for about 30, 40 years. So the research and work on Byzantine fault tolerance is about systems that have been in production for many years. I guess it has been rediscovered now with cryptocurrencies, but the academic lineage in cryptography and distributed systems is much longer. So in terms of, is this known or is it secure? We're building on very established technology. And, on top of that, the economic design is really there to complement this technology and scale it in a novel way. So when you think about most Byzantine fault tolerance systems, they're often implemented within a single firm. Why? Because, of course, that gives you the stronger security around that perimeter. Now, what's interesting about the design of Libra, and this is really highlighting why the association and the founding members are so important, is that each founding member, many of these, of course, are very global and trusted brands. So they have a lot to lose if they're not securing and operating that node properly. That gives them extremely high incentives to ensure that the data center is set up like a professional data center and there's all the protocols and procedures needed to make sure that the network is resilient to all sort of denial of service attacks and things that we see in the wild and that these companies experience regularly, on a daily basis. So you have these trusted nodes using technology that is well established. Of course, Facebook has been innovating and now the association and all the other founding members will keep extending and improving the R&D and open source code base around the protocol. But we're starting from a core that is well understood and then can also scale because not only you get a certain number of transactions per second at the public chain level, but there will be payment channels very much similar to other blockchains. And so if there's a wallet and it's interacting with users of a different wallet, they may not need to go through the public chain every time. They may be able to establish a channel between each other and transfer a number of transactions. So in the immediate term, it's already a very competitive blockchain to begin with. It will be improved, of course, over time in terms of scalability. And there's a roadmap for that. There's some of the best engineers and cryptographers working on these problems. But more generally, the structure with trusted founding members makes the network extremely resilient because, pick any one of those brands, they really want to ensure that the network works, that the network is live, and that the network can withstand pressure. And on top of that, they may be able to clear a large number of transactions within each other directly without adding traffic to the public chain. So, I think overall it's a design that builds on trusted and tested technology and tries to extend it incrementally and progressively so that it can really deliver essentially that reliance and that reliability that people will come to expect from a system of this type.
So you mentioned trust, and a lot of the time a payment system or digital currency requires trust and usability. It comes from the ability to convert into fiat currency. Is this something that you agree with, Jonas? Do you think that we require convertibility for any system? And Christian, can Libra guarantee this convertibility as well?
I think convertibility is indeed important because people want to an escape to their base currency at all times. And this is something that has hindered cryptocurrency for a long time. However, with this basket of safe assets, I think Libra is in a very good position to deliver such convertibility. Of course, it all depends also on the implementation and operational details of where are the converting entities located, etc., etc. But to begin with, to have a basket of safe and liquid assets that provides confidence that indeed the assets, the value is there to make the conversion. So yes, I think Libra would be well placed to provide such conversion, provided, of course, that it indeed is compliant with all regulation, that it receives licenses everywhere, because that's also a necessary ingredient where the traditional cryptocurrencies are trying to bypass or sidestep the traditional financial system, including its regulation. That makes it very difficult in fact, to provide convertibility, because this convertibility basically needs cryptocurrency to somewhere plug into the traditional financial system. But, well, we know that Libra and the Libra Association from the start is working with regulators to indeed obtain such licenses. So indeed, if they insert themselves into the existing financial system, they should be able to provide such convertibility.
Christian, your thoughts on this convertibility?
Those were excellent comments. So thank you for clarifying this matter already. That's exactly how it's going to operate. There's a few steps in the chain, and also market forces will help on this. Of course, it will be a process. It won't happen overnight that, you know, in every region, you will be able to come in and out on day one. But of course, over time, the hope is really that the market forces and incentives will drive the presence of on and off ramps. All these on and off ramps will be regulated. And so we'll have to comply, of course, with the local financial jurisdictions. There's one more step in the Libra supply chain that it's interesting to think about, which is that the reserve, to be extremely efficient, will interface with a small number of authorized resellers. So think of these as large financial institutions, so many of the brand names that you probably already know. And these entities will be in charge of doing the conversion together with the reserve. They will be able to charge a small spread relative to the basket. And the goal of the association will be to ensure that there's competition in that market so that that spread is very small. Now, what's interesting is that how do you reach multiple markets? How do you reach different segments of consumers? Well, exchanges, including some of those that, you know, already exist in the crypto space, plus some new ones, or banks or other financial players, will be able to interface directly with these authorized resellers. And so over time, you really see a network that develops where essentially driven by the spreads, users will be able to access the currency in all sort of different conditions and environments. Just to give you an example of how maybe the network could develop in novel ways, in some settings, you could have a telco operator that interfaces directly with an authorized reseller. And so now a user in a region can kind of buy Libra by simply using airtime. Or you could have a merchant that interfaces directly with an authorized reseller or with an exchange that performs the same operation at a point of sale. Or you could have a local bank that offers that as a service to their consumers. So I think we'll see a number of different experiments with different business models, but the overall economic design is there to ensure not only competition between the authorized resellers so that that market is based on very thin margins, but also the progressive development of an ecosystem, right? So you could have imagined an alternative approach where the Libra Association tries to build a presence in all these regions, and that would not really scale. And so here, the idea is to let the market build that network, build that availability, and really develop on and off ramps that can be both innovative and extremely efficient for users across the globe.
So you mentioned the Libra Association before. So the blockchain itself, the Libra blockchain, can be described as permissioned. So maybe how do you envision the Libra Association to make changes which are maybe seen as in the best interest for consumers? And do you maybe see an issue in making the blockchain more permissionless in the future? Is this something that you can do technologically? Is it viable, Christian?
That's an excellent question. And, you know, it's one of those things that keeps economists awake at night thinking through, you know, what is the market design? What are the changes to the protocol that need to be there to ensure that such a transition to a more open system is possible? So first of all, I'd like to clarify that, you know, relative to your traditional permissioned blockchain, there's a few major tweaks in Libra from the get-go. It is permissioned, but for example, there's an open membership criteria. In most permissioned networks, the platform architect, whoever is managing the digital ecosystem, can kind of decide who becomes a node, who doesn't become a node, who is allowed to clear transactions. And we didn't want that because we didn't want not even the association to kind of be controlling entrance into this open technology standard. So those open membership criteria are really there to ensure that this progressive opening and expansion of the network is possible. And it's extremely inclusive in terms of business models, in terms of economic regions. So it is a permission setup, but it's a very porous network that will evolve based on a market demand. And when you look at permission versus permissionless systems, at least as an economist, what really matters are the economic properties of a permissionless network. So as an economist, when I look at a permissionless network, what I like is the fact that it resembles an open technology standard. So very much like the standardization work that often happens at institutions like IEEE or IETF, if you do have an open protocol that people can build on, you suddenly get a lot more competition on top. So Libra was designed from the start, and this is why the association plays really a critical role, not as a walled garden, right? You could imagine a scenario where Facebook would have built a siloed application, very much like other payment solution or a wallet, But that would have been very different. In Libra, both incumbents and startups and traditional players, financial or not, can really compete on a level playing field because, first of all, there's entry criteria that are transparent and they are there to really ensure competition, both for the nodes and for the governance of the network. In the long run, I think the idea is one where users may be able to vote with their wallet. So by trusting one entity versus another, they're kind of shaping the governance of the platform indirectly. So not through a very cumbersome process where you would ping users every day on what they want the platform to do. The open standard nature of Libra is so important because it really ensures that there are low switching costs, there are low barriers to entry, whether you're a founding member or not. And in fact, we're seeing a number of open source wallets being built already for Libra. You can come and operate on the network and especially be interoperable with other merchants. So it won't matter if a merchant is supported by the Facebook wallet or some other wallet, they'll all be interoperable with each other. This is kind of the core innovation here. When you look at payments and financial services in general, they tend to be very siloed and fragmented. By creating an open platform and an open standard, the goal is really to induce lower prices, increase competition, and ultimately push all these players to improve the quality, develop new types of services. And a little bit like with the internet, many of these services and business models, I think, are difficult to predict today. They will be developed over time. Usually when you lower barriers and you kind of allow for more experimentation, you see some really interesting new applications. And so when I think about that longer term transition to a more even further and more open network, I think what really matters is that the network evolves in a way to allow for more competition, allow for someone, for example, to challenge an existing node and say, look, I can do a better job at running my node on the network, so I want to enter this space. That's really the core, I think, economic insight of a permissionless network. It's the idea that, you know, we want a system where anyone can come and compete, and ultimately, you know, the best applications for better use cases would succeed and get more traction over time.
I have a question about that. I very much see your point about the value of having an open network, open source code, an open infrastructure. And earlier on, you also said we want to address the fragmentation that exists in the existing payment infrastructures. And I see those points. However, you could indeed address all those points, I think, by indeed creating a new infrastructure like you are doing. However, you don't actually need to introduce a new synthetic currency on top. I mean, you could use this open infrastructure and even use the tokens on this infrastructure to move around existing currencies. So my question is, if indeed addressing the fragmentation in the current system is the goal, which I appreciate, then yes, a new infrastructure, that's great. But why is also a new coin on top, which brings with it all kinds of regulatory questions that are very difficult to sort out?
I think that's an excellent question. And, you know, in the early design, of course, we explored the possibility for an alternative scenario where you use the protocol to now enable all sort of cross-currency pairs. The challenge with those approaches is that they don't really scale. And so the idea here was to introduce a new type of payment network that has its native asset. And this native asset will be good for some use cases and not others. Again, as I was saying at the beginning, the fact that Libra is backed by a basket of currencies makes it a compelling asset for cross-border transactions like remittances. And more generally, we could have pegged it to a single asset, the USD or the euro, or create maybe two pairs, one for the USD, one for the euro. But when you think about it, you know, many cross-border transactions already incur today FX conversions, and they're slow, inefficient. And so when you think about that kind of use case, that kind of cross-border interaction, an asset that is more global in nature and can be used for these transactions is kind of a new proposition. And so, yes, I guess it could have been simpler for some of the regulatory uncertainty around such an innovative basket. But we do think that, you know, when you take a step back and ask yourself, okay, what can we do to ensure value preservation for the users to really guarantee that Libra doesn't have this wide swings in volatility that we've seen, for example, in other cryptocurrencies, anchoring it to any single currency would have been suboptimal for users in different regions. And so it's important to realize that it's meant to be an asset that is global in nature. And again, it will be useful for some things and not for others, but it's very hard to imagine the global use case without a broader representation of more than one currency.
And just to end, Tonis, how do you see the global payments landscape looking in the next 2 to 5 years? And Christian, what's the next step for Libra? And how do you also see the global payment system progressing in the next 2 to 5 years?
Well, I think indeed there will be lots of innovations. There's not only Libra, but there are also a number of other initiatives going on with digital currencies. Both central banks are looking at them. We all know the examples. The Bank of England, the Riksbank are a few examples, but also the Bank of Canada, the Monetary Authority in Singapore. But also in the private sector, there are a number of initiatives going on looking at sometimes blockchain-based solutions for payment infrastructures. And again, for me, a big question is, I mean, no doubt in the coming years, we will see these initiatives being built upon, and we will see experiments, and we will see the launch of maybe prototype digital currencies, or maybe in some countries, digital currencies for real. For me, the big question mark is indeed, will we see digital currencies like Libra that are synthetic in the sense that they are a new global currency with a currency basket? Because I think apart from the technical challenges, I think the biggest challenge is regulatory, because it has to be determined, such a supranational currency, what is it? Is it money? Is it a security? Is it an ETF? So really, I think regulators, well, that's what they are doing right now, no doubt, is thinking, what is this thing? How should we regulate it? And how to come with a globally consistent approach to a global proposal such as Libra?
And Christian, how do you see the next 2 to 5 years going? And what are the next steps for Libra, the biggest challenges and the biggest opportunities?
So Calibra's perspective, I think everyone on the team really looks forward to working with the other founding members and the association in defining really the improvements and changes to the design that are required based on feedback from regulators, central banks, and you know, all the other stakeholders. I think there's a lot of work that is involving already multiple founding members on the design of the reserve, the structure of the incentives, and really ensuring that the network and protocol can be the best possible network out there to deliver on that mission of financial inclusion and in a global efficient medium of exchange. That will require a lot of work. I think one of the things that all the founding members and others too that will join the ecosystem will have to work towards is really the last mile frictions. I think we tend to forget that, you know, the big complement to an efficient digital network is removing those frictions in the last mile, in that interface between a user, a small business, and that digital network. You know, the reason why the founding members and that initial seeding group of entities is so important is because all of them can really contribute to breaking down these barriers on the last mile and really achieve on the broader goal for Libra. I think it'd be fantastic. And this was, from a personal perspective, really what attracted me to this project was the opportunity to deliver on this idea of a low-cost, almost real-time settlement network that can enable all sort of fast and cheap payments on a global scale. Again, that will take time. I think it has an immense upside in terms of financial inclusion and increasing competition in all of these different verticals and democratizing access. I think ultimately the roadmap for Libra is one really to deliver on this idea that, you know, you have about 1.7 billion people that are unbanked, and you know, the vast majority of them, around a billion, has access to a smartphone. Many of these have access to data. Those are all endpoints. Those are all potential interfaces between a user and a global financial and payments network. You know, the road from delivering on that, of course, is going to be long. It's going to take time, but I think it's probably one that can actually deliver more financial inclusion and expand, you know, the types of services these people across the globe have access to. So again, I think a lot of work ahead, a lot of work in incorporating the feedback across many different jurisdictions. But, you know, to some extent, that's inevitable with any type of innovation. Innovations tend not to fit within an existing framework perfectly. And so they often fit into more than one framework. And I think what you're seeing is essentially the design being refined to really accommodate all these different frameworks and needs. But again, there's upside here in really creating something that can act as an open technology platform, can increase competition, and ultimately can benefit consumers. So that's kind of the exciting part, I think, from an economics perspective.
On that final point, that concludes this week's podcast. Thank you both for joining us. It's been a pleasure to speak to you.